better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3,548 of the Survival Podcast. And, you know, it just kind of hit me. That means we're going to hit 3,550 this week. But 3,550 won't be a live show. Dang it. It'll be an expert council Q&A show for this week. Tomorrow will be 3,549. And I'm going to have Moritz Kaminsky on, who is co-founder of Albi. And we'll be talking about Albi, which is a Bitcoin Lightning wallet, but we'll be talking about it as freedom technology. Bitcoin is only one thing that it does. It's actually a browser extension. It does a ton of things that enable you to use a lot of other freedom technologies very seamlessly. It's one of the most innovative technologies out there today. And because it's browser-based, not an app on a phone, that means it doesn't work on your phone, at least not without some extra efforts. But when it comes to using it, since it's browser-based, it's almost completely, you know, impossible to stop, because any sort of Chrome-based browser, it will work just fine on, and in some other browsers as well. But that's not what we're going to talk about today, though it's a good little intro ramp subject, because we're going to talk about today is designing your life for an uncertain future, and technology certainly should be part of this. But we're not going to come at it too heavily from a tech stance today. We kind of did that a little yesterday. We're doing that tomorrow. So let's take a more general approach to this. This also might be an episode, especially if you're new to the show and you've not heard me talk about things like designing your life before. You might feel a little beaten up today, especially if you're not part of the Gen X generation. The younger you are, the more you might feel, Jack's being mean. There might be some off-the-top rope, Randy Savage, fire-to-the-head style stuff today. I don't know. We'll see how far it goes. But I'm gonna lay out some realities for you today about the fact that we don't really know what the future's going to bring. But we know it's not going to be easy. And we know we're hitting a time of massive flux in society. There's been, if you just think about the last 5 years, exactly what I said was going to happen 5 years ago has happened. The amount of change, the flux, the speed of movement, the growth of government and government overreach, everything I've said would happen has, and some of us are thriving in it. I mean, we're in a society right now where inflation has done so much damage to people, but some of us are thriving. How? Well, because we're designers of our own lifestyle. So that's what we're talking about today. And, you know, I do talk a lot about lifestyle design, and when I use the term, I think people get the general idea because the words themselves are common. Lifestyle is the way in which a person lives, so I think when I say lifestyle, people get a pretty good image in their head of what that means, and design is purpose, planning, intention, and thought behind an action. In other words, if I design a thing like this little remote control right here, if I design this remote control and it doesn't exist, if I'm copying it, it's not design. If I'm copying it, it's emulation. But if I'm designing it, I think about what I want it to do. What is it for? How big do I want it to be? With the things that are available to me, how big can it be? How small can it be? What will cost the most to design it? Is it worth that much of an expense? Since all it is an on-off switch. There's all types of things that I would do, but somebody designed this. Now, this one in particular, who knows? This one might have been emulated from somebody else. But originally, somebody sat down and said, I'm going to make, for those who can't see it, this is a little switch from eTech City, and it is for little devices you plug into a wall outlet. And this just simply turns them on and off, on and off. That's all it does. And in here, what it does is it turns on my extra studio lights, and I don't really need them today, so we're going to leave it off. But somebody had to design that entire system, and they did it with purpose, plan, and intent. So if we take lifestyle design, we have the intentional and purpose-driven actions to give you the lifestyle you want. Intellectually, super simple to understand. Practically, and to the point where you'll do it, a little bit harder. Lifestyle design means put that purpose, the planning, the intention, and thought into how you live your life. So yeah, people will get it, but they'll usually struggle in putting it into their life so that they'll be resilient for tomorrow. I think we've all had these moments, haven't we? Like, you're really kind of happy with your life as it is. I think we all had a big one a few years back. With think of the pandemic as being a massive disruption, right? And then a couple things change and your whole life goes off the rails. And all of a sudden, the person that was generally content and happy with where they were in the world is miserable, right? And that's because they lack resiliency. Sometimes these external factors can be huge, like a COVID pandemic, or it can be a job loss. It can be internal factors, like maybe you kept a job longer than you really wanted to, and now you feel trapped in it because it pays really well. You don't have a lot of outside alternatives, and you got to pay the bills. And you've designed your lifestyle as a trap. You've raised your outgoing expenses to the point where you can't extract yourself from that job. These are all disruptions, traps, things that push us off the rails and make us unable to quickly return to a point of general contentment and pursuing our, you know, our ultimate goals. Every time we get sidelined, think of it like you're taking a trip. You're on your way to the store, you get a flat tire. Well, it's inconvenient, you're unhappy about it. Eventually it's going to cost you money, but you're going to have to stop, put your spare on, take some sort of credit. So your plan now, if you get to the store at, let's say, 1 o'clock, now you're going to get to the store at 1:30, and that's going to throw everything off down the road. The more you have redundancy in that plan, the less that disruption really matters. And the less you have redundancy in the plan, the whole thing can cascade off and throw a whole week off from one little thing, let alone a major disruption like something the governments of the world choose to do and consort together. Yeah. And there's just a few examples. No one can plan for everything. We're, you know, we're a survival podcast. We're a preparedness podcast. But today, things are so complicated. We all know the next few decades are going to bring us even more of this flux. So what I want to do with you today is talk to you about how to be prepared for that and how to adapt to that depending on where you're at in life. Because honestly, if I'm a 15-year-old kid right now, I would see opportunity everywhere. I see some shit that I'm very afraid of for those kids, government overreach, control, et cetera. But I also know humankind is pretty resilient and always resists that and eventually overthrows that. But if I look at all the stuff coming out right now and I'm 15 years old, I'm in that prime learning state. Kids can learn shit like so fast. You think they're screwing off and they learn more than you realize. Right? They come in and they tell you how to fix your shit on your computer and you're like, how do you know that? I thought all you do was watch videos or something. And no, they've figured it out, right? If you are in like your 20s and 30s, you have a lot of opportunity coming. If you're like me and you're in your 50s, you're not done yet, but you're kind of heading toward that. And there's a certain point where you start to feel like maybe all these new things can run over me and I won't be able to keep up. If you remember the first new Spider-Man movie, I don't remember who was in it, Toby something, right? In that movie, his uncle is looking for a job, you know, before he gets killed by the guy he lets go, all that. And he's like, damn, computer this, computer that, computer this, and the one ads. And like, I'm too old for computers, right? Like, I think we all have had the fear that that will, not necessarily computers, but something will flux to the point where our expertise are obsolete. And that's, I'm not going to tell you it's not going to happen. I'm not going to tell you it's not going to happen. What I'm going to tell you is that you can do things that make it matter a lot less, that make you more adaptable. That's what we're going to be talking about today. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is K9 Academy at k9academy.us. That's Joel Ryle's website. You should check that out, where you can learn to train your dog faster and easier than you ever thought possible. Joel's a great teacher. And, you know, we're talking about being adaptable today. You know, people that can train dogs, you're not going to run out of opportunities. It could actually be, I've never really thought of it this way, but it could be a gateway for people that want to get into this as maybe a side hustle business or something, being a dog trainer. If you're going to learn how to train dogs, learn from the best. Joel is among the best. And this is a really great, easy on-ramp to learn how to train your dog, whether you want to do something like that or you just want your dog to, like, not eat your chickens. Trust me, Joel can help you. You can even take a free class at K9 Academy. It's called the Problem Solving Library. Learn some of the most, you know, basic things. If you like that, move up to the core basics. Consider the other options. Check them out today. Again, k9academy.us. Next up today, Start 9 Embassy Servers. We're going to talk a little bit about tech today, but I think we're all aware of the fact that there are, and I can only use this descriptor, dark forces in the world that want to control what you're allowed to do, who you're allowed to talk to, when you can do it, how you can do it, what information you're allowed to see. It's really important when we see that as our future that we start thinking today about tomorrow's threats and taking back our technology and our control over our data, what we do, who sees what we do, and what we can see others do. Start9 is a great way to do that. They have an incredible product in the Start9 Embassy servers. You can check them out at start9.com. If you're an MSB member, you will get 9% off everything at Start9, which is a hell of a discount. If you stack that by buying a gift card to make your purchase for Start9 through the Fold app, then you can get another 9%. That's 18% off. That's a hell of a deal you can get by stacking tech as you improve your ability to do tech. All right, so let's get into this today. You know, I talk about major shifts all the time. And we are now at a point where, like, when I started talking about this, the shifts were coming. Now the shifts are happening, but they are really far away from where they're going. Like, it's you can always see massive impact by all of the technology, the different mindset, new forms of globalization, new forms of work from home, new forms of how we learn and how we teach. All of this is hitting really hard right now, but it's only really beginning. And that's important to understand. Like, if you, again, if you go back 5 years, so 2019, pre-pandemic to today, and you look at really what's occurred just in that five-year period, it's pretty impressive. I'm going to tell you that what's going to happen between now and the end of the decade is going to make it look like Disneyland. Like, it's just, like, not even that big of a deal. And there's really five areas I want to hit on. Education, technology, manufacturing, transportation, and then a catch-all everything. So what's that look like? So just from a standpoint of education, there are more people educating their children at home today than any time in America. And if we did it per capita, it's more than any time since there has been the option to send kids to school on a regular basis. Like, there's never been a time since the dawn of the modern education system in the mid, late 1880s till today, when as many people were educating their kids at home. And when I say educating their kids at home, I don't mean they don't go to school and they learn how to, you know, use the plow and run the farm for dad. I mean literally making sure they have a well-rounded and probably better-rounded education that they get at home than they would get in the school system. Well, that's just part of it, though, isn't there? People are choosing to learn things differently today. It wasn't that long ago that when anybody wanted to, like, make a career change, the first thing they looked for was a college program or a trade or tech school to do it. Today, we have people literally using YouTube as a university. That doesn't always work out the best, but a lot of times it does. There isn't much to do that can be done right now by other people that somebody hasn't done and then step-by-step explained how they did it on YouTube or some other platform. So we already have people that are simply partaking in a, well, I would guess, fully semi-automated educational system, and that somebody has to generate the content. People are incentivized to generate the content. More eyeballs equals more money. And markets provide feedback, and so people realize that these things will help them in some way. And even the person with a little channel that makes $50 a month, right, knows that's $50 a month I wouldn't have had otherwise. And I can't tell you how many, I mean, I've had things like rent a car. Okay, how the hell do I get the freaking gas cap open? I'm pushing on it, prying on it, looking underneath. And, you know, you just put the model number of the car, because it's not a car you owned or drove for, in YouTube, open gas cap. And there's a freaking video of some guy. And a lot of times it's not even a guy that, like, is a professional YouTuber. You can tell he was in the same spot you were, and he was pissed off, and he was like, I am going to freaking do this so that the next person that has this problem can find where the damn thing is, you know? And it's like under the seat or some shit, there's a button to open the gas cap. And by the way, if you want to ask questions the way you see it right there, if you're in the live stream, that's how. The word question in all caps, I'm not going to read it, but I am going to mark it and we will come back to it. So Tom says he had that. I've had that exact problem. So have I. I mean, I tell you, a real world situation, like, where I got to fill the car. Like, I didn't have the car that long, right? But you have to bring the car back full, and you're trying to get to the airport, and you got to make your plane on time, or they're going to leave without you. Because I made a deal with the airlines. If I'm not there on time, they can leave, and they keep their end of the deal all the time with that. They don't keep the deal with, like, the plane will leave when you said it was going to leave. But if they're ready to leave and I'm not there, they go ahead and go. So, you know, you're stressed out. How do I open this? And, like, I literally have a dude. And actually, I remember another time it happened. It was a Sprinter van that we rented to go to an event, Mother Earth News event down in Bastrop, Round Rock or something like that, down near Austin. And we had that was another time. And it was this weird ass thing. It was like inside the door or something where the gas cap was. And so there's with the really simple things like that. But then, like, Brian here is mentioning PHP, HTML, Python, et cetera. Like, people are learning to code online. And now we're hitting a place where we can take technology and education together. And if you can learn to half-ass code and you can use AI, all of a sudden you code pretty damn good. And the more you do it, the more you learn. And every time, you know, the ChatGPT bot or whatever makes an error in the coding and you have to figure out what it is and you drop some code in and say, debug this, or you go look it up and you figure out how to fix it, you get better, you get faster, you get more agile. So the education market is a complete land of flux. It is only a matter of time before the colleges, as we know them, cease to exist. There'll always be a Harvard, a Yale, a Stanford, stuff like that. And there'll always be those middle-tier state schools. There'll always be a lot of people that go to high school and then go to college and get a job and pursue their degree. But there's going to be a lot less of them. We've gotten to a point now where it's like if you don't go to college, you're a loser. And kids are starting to look at all the adults around them that went to college and are like doing things like, you know, making lattes or working in a bookstore that will soon be out of business, making lattes or, you know, any number of things or even have good jobs. But when you talk to the adult and you go, well, what'd you go to school for? And they're like, I went to school for XYZ, but you do ABC. Yeah, well, that's not, like they're going, wait. And, you know, you have young people now realizing, hearing their older siblings that are only 10 years older or less older than them, just a little bit past them, they're still in school. And that person who went to college is saying they'll never be able to buy a house. And they're thinking, wait a minute, you just spent as much money on your education as you could have bought a house for. I'm not sure I understand this, and I don't want to do this anymore. And there's just going to be more and more of that. So, and this education collapse is multifaceted. It is because there are other options now, and many of them are better for certain people. But the other side of it is there's just less people. We're not having babies like we used to. We are not at replacement rate. For all of the bad things about immigration, at least it's preventing a population collapse. I should say for all the things that are bad about illegal immigration and untethered, unknown illegal immigration, right now we would be already in a significant population decline without immigration. Both legal and illegal have contributed to not going into that. We are not at replacement rate. And with that, and we haven't been. And we haven't been for about, you know, 20 years. So what happens about 18 to 20 years after a young person is born? Well, they get out of high school and they go to college. This is called the enrollment cliff, and it's hitting right now, but it will hit in its first year of full force for enrollments in 2025. And the colleges are already shitting their pants over this. And if you start looking around this country, you're going to find hundreds, thousands of small colleges, private universities, et cetera, that continue to downsize. And around every one of those colleges is a town. And that town exists because that college is there. That influx of new young people with money to spend every year. As those close, towns will start to fold in like they have all over the country, but driven by the educational shifts. So education is one of those places that people have always kind of just thought like this. If you're a teacher, you work 30 years, 40 years, whatever it is, and you retire, and you don't worry about it. You'll be fine. Yeah, not so much anymore. But then there's going to be second, third, and fourth order effects of this massive shift. And that's just education. Technology, which plays into all this. But technology is going to get to a point where it's going to be one of the greatest liberators and greatest imprisoners of humanity at the same time. In fact, we've already seen that. Tell me that we were not both more captive and more free in, let's say, 1995 at the dawn of the internet when a lot of people didn't even have it. And even if you did, it wasn't, there was no Twitter X, there was no Facebook, there wasn't even a MySpace yet. Nobody was even slinging music around on LimeWire or something or Napster or whatever, right? Like, that time it was just a gimmick. It was a game, and there were some chat boards and stuff, and that was it. And people put up this website, it looked like a five-year-old made it, and they thought they were experts, right? Like, we were pretty free then, right? And we are more controlled by technology than we were then. Are we not more, also at the same time, it's weird, isn't it? We are also more free. In 1995, if you wanted to know something, how'd you find out? How did you find out? Especially if, like, nobody in your immediate orbit knew it. How do you find out today? In seconds. Remember your teacher, if you grew up in the 80s, right? You're not going to have a calculator everywhere you go. Miss Matchett, you lied. I know you're probably dead by now, but you lied to me. I have a calculator everywhere I go. New old man says, a book. But where'd you get the book? A library? What if your library didn't have the book that had the information that you needed in it? What if you needed to talk to somebody? Man, I remember 1988. Like, I'm just, it could be 87, could be 86, could be 89, just in that run, right? If you're a kid and Aunt Sue or some shit called your house and wanted to talk to you, it's Aunt Sue. She's on long distance. Get in here. And boy, you better run your ass in there, right? Like, you want to talk to Aunt Sue now, you talk to her five times a day. It don't cost nothing. See, technology both enslaves and frees. It all depends on how it's used and who's behind it. And this is why in this flux, we have to become masters of technology. Because if we do not become masters of technology, then what's going to happen? Can somebody complete that for me, please? If you do not master technology, then anybody here want to say it, right? I'll talk on some other stuff while you do that. I'm going to say it one more time. I want to hear it. If you do not become a master of technology, then fill in the blanks, see if anybody gets it. But people are saying things like old people, microfiche, about where you got the information from, right? The dreaded card catalog. Mix got it. If you do not master technology, technology will master you. And here's what but on that other aside, right? But how long did it take? How long did it take to get an answer? How many times did you say, fuck it, it's not that important? How many times can you do that over your life to where your accumulated knowledge has seriously suffered? So we have this amazing ability in education and technology right now to move faster, to do more, but also to be controlled more. And this is why when AI really started taking off, to the chagrin of many people in this audience, you must learn to use it. Because if you don't, then they will use it on you. And since you do not understand the pattern that shows what's being done, you won't know it's being used on you, and that's when it will be most effective. When you know somebody's doing something to you, unless they're really good and you're really weak in that space, it's not very effective. When a magician does a trick, you know it's a trick. You know it's an illusion. You know it's not magic. But when the pretty girl appears on the on the stage, the raised stage, she was right here. Now she's right there. Where'd she go? It's still amazing. You're entertained. You'll buy a ticket. You'll pay good money to go see it. But if you know exactly how it's done, even if you don't quite see where they pulled it off, everything goes away. It doesn't work on you anymore. And that's how technology is. When you truly understand the technology that's being used against you and how it's being used against you, somebody posts something, for instance, is supposed to engagement farm you and get you mad, right? And you go, that's fake. I do it with my wife all the time. She's like, well, that's fake. Did you look it up? Nah. I can tell by the way it's phrased. I can tell because it's so ridiculous and outside the box. And then every once in a while you're like, maybe. And you look at it a little closer, you go, 90% that's fake. You look it up, that's fake. because you recognize the pattern. If you don't recognize the patterns, you're going to be controlled by the pattern that you do not recognize. The technology will master you. So technology is just going to continue this massive shift in all factors of our life, and it's going to continue to eliminate jobs. And it's going to eliminate jobs first where it's doing it right now. High-paid, upper-middle-class professionals are the ones that are most being hit by this right now. Copywriters, programmers, developers, and they're not losing their jobs. Just the number of them required is going down. Because, you know, when we get to this point where one programmer could do the work of five, well, then we hire one, maybe two, but three of them don't have a job anymore. The skills in demand, it's just somebody else has it, and it's a bunch of GPUs spinning in a bank. And that's one way that the technology thing hits, right? And it's going to hit because I want to replace or reduce headcount of the most expensive part of my labor force first as an entrepreneur. Being an entrepreneur is tough. Let me tell you what you don't like as an entrepreneur, employees. You might love the people, but you don't like the general concept. Every employee is a potential problem. I know if you're an employee, that's hard to hear. I know that you don't want to believe that. But when I have a small company with eight people in it, and that's my entire company, and I have one person that handles dispatching of my vehicles, and they have to take off work today because their kid's graduating from fucking kindergarten, I hate them on that day. I love them the day before, love them the next day, hate them that day, right? If you're not Hewlett Packard with 20,000 employees or some shit like that, where, you know, five people could take off any given day, no one even gives a shit. But for small to mid-sized businesses, missing one or two people over bullshit, that alone, they're upset today, my mom called, whatever. It's not that I don't care, it's that I have a business to run. So every place I can eliminate humans, the less shit I have to deal with. I know, that, again, if you work for a living and you work hard, that sounds like the most asshole thing I could say. But all I'll tell you is run a business. You know, I used to run a business with 50 primary employees and 2,500 contractors active at any given time. Every day, something was a problem because somebody had a problem in their life that became our problem. And we were big enough to absorb it. I've also run much smaller companies, and you lose one or two people for like a week, holy crap. You're taking a bath financially, but if a robot can do the job, and it doesn't necessarily have to be like, you know, a robot, animatronic, human-type robot, well, then that problem goes away. If I can eliminate 50% of my workforce, I'm going to eliminate 50% of my personnel problems. I'm going to be able to look at things and go, if I have really high-end tech, and a person doesn't have to be quite top-level, and I have somebody that's like a genius top-level performer, but their personality makes them a pain in the ass. They have a predisposition to take time off. They drink, whatever. I'll keep the second-tier guy and marry him with the first-tier tech and get rid of the person that's a prima donna, the person that knows they can get away with shit. They're out the door first. I don't need you anymore. I'll keep, if I had 10-man headcount in a department and technology lets me go down to one man, I'll keep two. Now, I've two is one, one is none. One is sick. One's kid is graduating kindergarten, whatever. I've got the other one. Everything keeps running. We'll see how that works. This is coming to everything because then the next thing we want to do is get rid of low-end workers. I mean, we all know self-checkout is kind of a disaster, but it's better than it was, isn't it? Like, the reason I never did it before is it didn't work worth a shit. You're always having some come over and do something for you, whatever. But we really are going to get to a point. You're not going to go to a freaking cash register. Cash registers are like toll booths. It is only resistance to change that's keeping them in place. There's almost no toll booths left in Texas. The technology to get rid of every toll booth in the United States existed in 1990. It's an RFID card and a reader and a camera and a Department of Motor Vehicles database. So if you don't have the RFID tag to get you the discount, you get a bigger bill in the mail. There's still places where people sit in the toll booth and collect money, like New Jersey, because the unions are stronger there. We don't need them. If we can track 60,000 vehicles a day on a Dallas North tollway, or 60,000 vehicles an hour, then we can figure out how to charge people for their groceries without a freaking cash rate. It's a fucking obstruction point, right? We can, you know, right now, Amazon has thousands, hundreds of thousands of employees, right? Millions of employees. A lot of them work in the warehouses. They're treated like dog shit. They don't really want the job. They need a job. Yeah, the women have to go in with clear purses because they're afraid they're going to steal a fucking tchotchke or something. Who knows? But they also have robots running around those warehouses, reorganizing everything constantly. There's thousands and thousands of jobs just in like one major market where Amazon has multiple huge warehouses. Like in the Dallas-Fort Worth market, there's already thousands of jobs that weren't eliminated. They were avoided ever being created. And this will just continue. We'll get to a point where an Amazon warehouse, when you walk in there, you won't feel much life force. There won't be many people in there. Everything is data-driven and managed and filed and cataloged and organized. It's perfect for autonomous intelligence to move shit around, load trucks. Pretty soon, that Amazon truck that comes, there won't even be a person driving it. There won't be a person driving it, which means it can run 24/7, 365. And don't think they won't. Now, this is where this becomes a problem. We keep hearing as all this tech develops, you know, stupid shit like remember when they shut the pipeline down and they told the guys who were pipeline workers and roughnecks and shit to learn the code? And that became a meme. And now whenever government people claim about being laid off, people are like, huh, learn the code, fucker, right? But the overriding mindset is we need to train people today for the jobs of tomorrow. Nothing like some political bullshit. But I just want to ask you a question, an honest question, America. Think about people you know and people you interact with on a daily basis. And think about some of the people that are like in their 40s and they're doing the type of jobs that maybe you did when you were 15 or 16 years old. They're stocking shelves in a grocery store, checking people out in a grocery store, loading a truck. They work a construction job, but they have no real understanding of anything. They dig ditches. They fill ditches. They dig holes. They show up. They're day workers. Maybe they're day workers with actually a job, but they function like a day worker. Maybe they're a little bit above that and they run the day worker crew or something. And across the board, they mow lawns, they clean pools. There's nothing wrong with any of that. And there's plenty of intelligent people that do these things. Okay? There's plenty of intelligent people that do all these jobs. I'm talking about the person, you look at that person and you say, God bless you that you have a job doing something like that because you're at your limit. How often have you been to a grocery store, you went to check out, and you thought to yourself, this person is at the limit of their mental capacity right now. Like, they can't do more. Okay. The beauty of our economy up till now, being so people-focused, is all of those people, if they wanted something to do, could find something to do. What happens when you wipe that sector out? Do you think you're going to train these people for the technology of tomorrow? This is how you get the idiocracy. The technology masters them. And so you're going to have to deal. Yeah, well, that's not going to happen to me, Jack. I can figure shit out. I can learn shit. I have all kinds of hard skills and soft skills, man. I take this shit seriously. I listen to you. Yeah, but if you're prepared and a disaster hits, you still have to worry about all the people around you. This is a long, slow, unraveling disaster that you're looking at. And it is part of our transition to whatever's next for us. And, you know, I'll tell you something. Whether you believe in evolution or not, evolution believes in you. And some members of the species, and the species survives and thrives and does just fine, some members don't make the trip. Some members get their genes culled. Yeah? Darwin wasn't wrong about that. I don't care if you believe in creation and God and whatever. You can see how evolution works, okay? And some people don't survive the upgrade. And that is scary when it's going on around you because they all demand the people that do survive provide for them. That's the future you're heading into right now. Manufacturing, all this technology pulls into that. We keep talking about manufacturing jobs, manufacturing jobs, manufacturing jobs. We're living in the past. We're living in the past. The American high ran from about 1945 to about 1965, and it tailed off and died in the 70s, and it got murdered in what was left of it in the 80s. And it was only about 20 years. But when you listen to people talk about it, you would think it was a century. blue collar workers that only the dad worked and the mom stayed home and they had a house and a car and mom got a car in only 5 years and then they had two cars in every driveway. Wait a minute, that was Hoover, right? Yeah. two chickens in every pot, and two cars in every garage. We actually got it in the 50s and 60s. It all went away. And it was like blue collar manufacturing, construction, like any guy that wanted the work, that had a strong back and a good work ethic, could get a job that paid a decent wage. And a lot of it was manufacturing. Detroit exploded, right? All of, not just one, but all the major car makers. And then all of those car makers, they didn't make all their own shit. So somebody would open up a factory and all they were making was starter motors and selling them to Ford and GM or something like that. And then that had second and third order positive effects. And all these other people came in. But because of that, we look back and we envy our grandfathers because they could get good manufacturing jobs. Have you ever done one? They're not the best jobs to have. You know, some of the factories in China that are like peopleless now and are almost 100% automated, they didn't do it because people are expensive in China. They have basically legalized slave labor. They can have people work for nothing. You know what was happening? People that worked those jobs were fucking killing themselves. I mean, literally, like, factory workers had a suicide rate at like 6x the average Chinese person. What? Because it's not rewarding. It's not rewarding. So it's a job that people claim they want, but nobody really does. What it was at the time of the high in America was entry level. If you worked on the line at GM, like I had an uncle that worked, my mother's sister's husband in New Jersey, he worked for GM. We bolted shit on frames of cars all day, every day. And he really liked his job. He didn't like his job. He liked having his job. There's a difference. He was paid well. Union job, union benefits, 8 hours a day. If he was pushed in overtime, he made buku money, but he didn't like, oh, I love what I do. But he realized if I do this, I'll become a line supervisor. Then maybe I'm a shop supervisor. Like there was a progression there for people that stayed and worked hard. And so even the part that we think we want, we don't want it for that reason. What all that means is that people are not really addicted to working in factories. It's not a lot of fun to work at a factory. Who the fuck, when you're a kid, they say, what do you want to grow up, be when you grow up? I want to be a cowboy. I want to be an astronaut, right? I want to be a policeman. I want to be a firefighter. Who the fuck says I want to work in a factory? I want to put lamps together, right? I want to assemble television sets, right? Even if it's high tech, I want to sit in a place and watch computer chips roll by and look at a screen and get so tuned into the pattern I can go, bad chip, bad chip, bad. Who wants to do that? So it will all be replaced, which, by the way, is part of the plan of the communists. Replace everything with artificially intelligent machines so humans can sit around and do nothing. Well, humans don't work that way. And everything that's ever promised us hasn't worked out very well. So there will be elements of that moved into it. UBI brought into the discussion. I promise you, before the end of the next administration, I don't care if it's Trump or Kamala, you will start to hear serious discussion at the federal level of UBI. Not these little test case scenarios in some town in San Francisco or whatever. More and more serious discussions about that. Yep. Thank God I'm a plumber, says New Old Man. And there are jobs that will stay valid for a very long time. Just, again, more competition to get into. Pipe fitting, plumbing, electrical work, data cabling. There's a lot of things that, if it has to be adjusted on the fly, right, and it can't be adjusted with if this, then that, if literally two guys sit around and go, well, the header over that door is a double header, and we need to put a hole through it, but the customer doesn't want a hole through it, but this cable has to get there, and it has to be less than 295 feet. Like, if it requires that level of thought, we're well away from that happening. But getting the cable to the job site? Why am I paying a cable tech $25 an hour to do something a robot can do for almost no cost? That's what I'm saying. That's where things are going to take a definite turn. We also have, again, transportation is part of all this. You're going to pick your phone up not so long from now and do something like an Uber, and a vehicle's going to come get you and there's going to be nobody in it. And there's places where you can already do that. But imagine when it's everywhere. And here's what people have always said. I will never give up my freedom. Yeah, well, I just looked yesterday at a freaking window sticker of an F-150, an F-150 Ford pickup truck, $75,000. I'm already ahead if I use Uber, unless I already own a car. I have a used car. They're going to put kill switches. All the cars starting next year are going to have kill switches in them. They can turn your car off if they want to. They will mandate so much more tech into vehicles that you better get an older one right now. You better get two. You might, if you have a big garage like me, I might buy a couple of used vehicles in the next couple of years that I can maintain and take care of myself and buy the most common parts that fail. Go ahead and buy them now. They're not going to go bad, right? You're not buying eggs or cheese or meat here. You know, a starter motor is a starter motor. Freaking a serpentine belt is a serpentine belt. A hose is a hose, right? A brake pads are brake. A brake pad will live longer than you, especially if it's not being used. Like, literally, that's and Steiny says he's making a joke, but it's you know what? I don't know that another year it will be a joke. He said, "Was it a base model? 75K seems low these days. You take $75,000 on a pickup truck." And a person with decent credit paying 9.5-10% on a car loan, because I'm an old fucker with perfect credit, and they want to give me 7. And I'm like, fuck you, I'm just going to pay the truck off in full. Like, we're about to buy our truck that we've been leasing right now from Toyota. Because the purchase price, there's no problem with. But when I look at the interest rate on it, I'm like, you're out of your fucking mind. I'm not doing this. I'm not financing a freaking 3-year-old vehicle for 5 more years. For freaking $650 a month, you've got to be out of your freaking gasket. Not that long ago, I could have been rolling around in a Porsche for that and buying it. So I'm telling you, they are going to, this is an intentional, willful thing to make the cost of transportation so high that all this technology must come. It's the plan. And you know, even your orange Superman is in on this, right? So Biden implemented a 100% tax on Chinese electric vehicles manufactured in Mexico. You know who's about to do it as well? Fucking Trudeau in Canada. This is the orange man's ideal, right? The hero of the right. Two of the most leftist motherfuckers in the world are doing what he said he would do when he got in. Now, you can talk about protecting the American manufacturing sector all you want or whatever, but if you actually want us to switch from driving around gas guzzlers to clean electric vehicles, if you actually mean that, and there's a way for Americans to start buying really nice electric vehicles, by the way, for under $30,000. I mean, vehicles that would blow your mind if you look at any of the footage from any of the freaking car shows and shit, like your kids are in the back each watching a big screen with their own movie, and your car's halfway driving itself already. And you plug it in when you get home and you don't buy gas anymore, you can get that for $28,000. But you can't because your own government has made it where it doesn't even make sense to import that. But Mexico's going to have them everywhere. Like, why do you think they're doing this? Andrew says he wants a Hilux. Yeah, old Toyota Hilux is a hell of a vehicle. Like, they've gotten rid of everything affordable. It wasn't even that long. I remember I went to a car show about 10 years ago. And Ford had really nice, like, base model, slightly upgraded, a little bit of appearance package on them. You know, F-150 extend cabs, they were $28,000 just 10 years ago. Now they're selling that truck for $75,000. Go look at the price of a standard cab base model F-150 today and go look at an F-150 from 1975 and do the inflation-adjusted cost, and the delta's insane. They're destroying our freedom of movement by destroying access to the things that let us move. Because once you put everybody into this centralized transportation society, you have control like you've never had before. Because if I'm summoning the Uber robot with my phone knows I did it. My carrier knows I did it. My government knows I did it. The people that own the vehicle that's transporting me know I did it. They know what time it picked me up. They know what time it dropped me off. They know where it dropped me off. Did it drop me off at a law office, a court, a liquor store, Walmart, a concert? It knows everything about me. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Look up what the average car payment is today. Humble Mechanic says, I can't do that mid-flow. Somebody do that for me right now. What is the average car payment in America right now? I'd like to know that. I bet you it's something insane. I'm going to guess it's somewhere between $600 and $800, which I have never had a car payment like that in my life, and I've driven some nice vehicles. $600, $800 is what I'm going to guess. In some reason, and I promise I didn't cheat, $880 just popped into my mind like that, which seems nuts. But somebody figured $750. Okay, I was wrong. It's off by over $100. Liberty Guard says $750. Did you look that up? Did you know that? You know? $726. That's a very specific number from Humble. And that is a number we can bank on. But there's something he put in there that if you're not on the live stream and you're not looking at it right now, you'll miss for 68 months. So that's 5 years and 8 months. And that's what they keep doing. They keep extending the payment. They offered us, well, we need a lower payment. We'll do 72 months on a three-year-old truck. I didn't even know it's a Toyota and all, but no, fuck you. Right. But I'll show you. I'll pay it. I'll pay it off in cash. You were close. Liberty Garden says it was just a guess, but he said 750 and Humble said 726 to 68 months. I'm going to tell you, Liberty, if we were running a contest and you weren't allowed to look it up, you would have won because everybody would base that number on 60 months. And if you adjust that number on 60 months of payments, I bet you are within the hair of a gnat's ass away from the right number. Wow. And that's average. That's effing average, Humble says. How much more can that number go up before everything breaks? And people just say, nope. Okay, now what happens to manufacturing, right? Who's going to buy a vehicle? Now what happens to Ford, Chevy, GM, fucking Tesla, everybody? The only people who can afford to make a car you can afford are the Chinese and your own government. Make sure you can't buy it. Because let me tell you what would happen. Let me tell you what would happen if they didn't put 100% tariff on those Chinese electric vehicles. All of a sudden, American manufacturers would figure out how to manufacture those vehicles at a price you could afford because they would have to compete. That's called a market. When we disrupt markets, we fuck things up. And Humble also says, and he would know, 84-month loan is a common loan now. 84 months. What is that? 7 years. 7 fucking years to buy a car. And it makes sense. You know, I said I saw that sticker on an F-150, $75,000. Back in 1998, my wife and I bought our first house, 2 bedrooms, 2 baths, 1,800 square feet, 2-story, 1/4-acre lot. Just ass hair under a 0.24-acre lot. Nice subdivision, Arlington, Texas. And it was a sweet spot at the time, especially. Arlington City, Mansfield Schools. It was like cracked Babe Ruth, home run. $84,250. And our payment was around $1,000 a month on a 30-year loan on a house. Because interest rates were 7% back then on houses. Especially, you know, first timer using his VA, not putting any money down. He paid about $1,000 a month to buy a house. I bet you today, most people on that Ford F-150 would cost them more than I was paying monthly for my house over 7 years versus buying the house over 30. They're going to destroy the ability to do this. And then everything is going into flux. If you just think about like everything I said touched everything else. So we have to become extremely adaptable. So what's always worked? What have we always seen work for people no matter the flux? Because if you think, oh my God, this flux is insane. What do you think the flux looked like between, let's say, 1829 and 1869? I mean, 40 years. I think most people today would have been eaten alive by what that looked like. We went through the Civil War. We went through massive industrialization. The first internal combustion engines were out by then, right? Like, and then let's go 1869 to what, 1939. Advent of World War II and the changes that came to that. Cars all of a sudden, like, you go look at a picture of Manhattan in 1901, you'll find like one little podunk first generation car putting around, and there's horses and mules everywhere, and the street is full of horse shit. Go find a picture of Manhattan in 1915. If there's a horse, it's pulling a pretty wagon for rich people to ride around in the park like they do today, and it's all cars. So this flux, don't think it's new. It's because it's miserable, because you have to live through it, that you're different. And so what has always made people adaptable? One is entrepreneurship. People who are actual entrepreneurs, not self-employed. Self-employment alone does not equal entrepreneurism. I had a good friend of the family when we lived in Pennsylvania for a few years, back when I worked for Fluke. His name was Bobby, and he was a drywaller. And if you ask him what he did, he said, I have my own business. I'm in drywall. Do you make drywall? Oh, no. Okay. Do you, like, design? Do you have, like, a shop? No. What do you do? Well, I work independently, and when there's a job, I bid, and then I go in, I do the drywall work. So you're an employee without a leash. Now, I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying, when the building crisis hit and all of the new construction went to shit and people couldn't get money and remodels went to shit, he didn't go under, but it got tough for that family because he didn't have an adaptation he could make. He couldn't quickly just switch to doing something else, right? He couldn't go out, like if you were in construction and you really were, you're not, you do framing the same way Bobby did drywall. If you were actually in construction, as in you designed and managed and acted as a general contractor building things, it might have been still a hard time, but you could have changed your focus from residential to commercial. You could have changed your focus to commercial remodel, knowing the commercial sector didn't have the money for complete new building and had to make do with what they could. You could have anticipated it, seen it in advance, and made the shift before it was necessary, so you got ahead, because everybody's going to get that idea once it happens. Entrepreneurs have that flexibility. They can change their direction. They can change their state of operation. Right, you can be in a place and they do something really stupid with some sort of tax on business, but it's a state level tax. And if you're a true entrepreneur, you can move your business to Texas. You know, when California really pissed off Elon Musk, he said, that's the end of that shit. I'm moving this one too. I'm moving everything to Texas. Go fuck yourself. Now, we're not going to be Elon's, all of us, but we can emulate that ability, that flexibility. So entrepreneurship has always been something that's worked for people. Adaptability and flexibility, that's part of the advantage of being an entrepreneur, but having just a mindset to be as strong as a towering oak, but as fluid as a weeping willow. You know, when you get a big windstorm, you'll see sometimes around here, these oak trees that were 100 years old, just like tornadoes come through, like low-level F1s or F0s, and they rip the top off the tree, destroy this 100-year-old oak. Down the road's a willow. A lot of leaves are missing. A few sticks and twigs here and there, but the tree's basically just like, hey, I'm riding it out, right? You have to have both that strength, but also that adaptability and flexibility to get through this, because we just don't know what's going to happen. Your mind already has to be of the opinion that I am going to be fine. Now, it can't be the movies where grandma's knitting in the chair, rocking back and forth. It's all okay. And the house is on fire. Everybody's trying to get grandma. She says, nothing's wrong. It's all, grandma, the fire is on the ridge. It's coming down. It's going to burn the whole fucking barn, the house, everything. No, it's all. I don't mean you have to have the mindset I'm going to be fine that way. You have to have the mindset of some bad shit's going to happen and I'm going to be fine. Because I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to work it out. That mindset going into it alone is often the difference between people who thrive and people who get destroyed. Hunting, gathering, growing. I grew up where everybody did it, and it always worked. There was never this fear that we wouldn't eat. Now, sometimes there was a fear we might not have money to pay a bill, but most of the people I knew owned their houses too. The only bill they had was a property tax bill, you know? Most people I knew own their own cars. Like, financing a car just wasn't real common where I grew up in rural Pennsylvania. Most adults were driving cars that were 5 or 6 years old when they bought them new, right? When they first bought them, they were buying returns and things like that. Only the rich people bought new cars, and they paid cash for them. Or if they did finance them, you know, they financed them for 2 or 3 years, and they paid them off and drove them for 10. Well, so they didn't worry about paying bills, but they really didn't worry about eating. Like, I talk about how I grew up, and I say that we hunted and we fished and we gardened for food, not as a hobby. And I think when I say that, sometimes people think that I mean that we were like, man, if we don't get something, we're going to start. No, we're like, no, I'll shoot a fucking deer. If I don't get one in deer season, I'm going to shoot a deer. That's adaptability and flexibility. I have an extra car battery and an old headlight and a 22. I'm going to eat. Like, it's going to be all right. Like, I know where the fish are. We you know, I know that we have, you know, 40 quarts of pickles, 40 quarts of chow chow, 15 bags of onions and garlic down in the cellar. We just didn't worry about that. And that meant when things happened, when somebody lost a job or something, they just rolled through it. And a lot of times what would happen is when somebody would be in a bad way, and you knew they were struggling to get through it, and you knew that they were working, they were trying, they weren't just sitting there waiting for, like, people would be like, hey man, you know what, here, boom, like, people would start bringing them food and shit, because food didn't cost you anything except your time, and you had more than you needed. So, like, if everybody chipped in, this family ate well for 3 or 4 weeks while dad found a new job. And this has always been the case. If you go back to the way things were in England during the war, the World War, I really suggest you watch a really wonderful British series if you've never watched it. It's on YouTube and free. It's called Wartime Farm. And there were serious stresses on farmers. And a lot of what they produced, they actually were forced to sell. They could only keep so much. But they did way better than people in the city, so much so that people in the city would send their kids to help out on farms just because they know they'd be fed well. This has always worked. Oh, chow chow, you're right. Anyone can golf. I miss my grandma's chow chow. And plenty of people have given me chow chow. It's always good. But it's one of those things that die with my grandma that I wish didn't. I wish I had the recipe for the way she did it, because it was just perfection. But hunting, gathering, growing, a solid conservative approach to risk balance. Okay? So there's three types of people when it comes to risk. And we're going to use investing here, but it's also taking a job, taking a new job, going back to school, moving, buying a second house. Like, there's a million ways to look at this. But let's use Bitcoin. So Bitcoin was one of those once-in-a-generation opportunities that if you aped in back in, like, 2010 or something, you're a billionaire now, right? But for everything that looked like that at that point in its existence, aping in just meant losing all your money, okay? So you have people that will, they have no risk aversion whatsoever. They try everything and they go all in on everything. And they use the same philosophy that people that play roulette and basically knock off 9 numbers on the board with, you know, 4 chips each on corners do, where you're never really going to win that much. But someday this one in the center might hit and I'm going to take enough risk that the big payout will come, right? Well, there's some problems with that. One is the people, when they do actually hit it, they almost always piss their money away. Just go look up how many people win lotteries and are bankrupt within 5 years. It's the same mindset. They're just ape in, risk everything. Okay. Now, there's another thing that you could have done at that point. I didn't trust this. I will buy a CD in the bank and make 2% and be happy. And I don't take any risk whatsoever, even though the risk was like a few $100. Right? So you stay out of it all the way. That is overly conservative versus overly liberal with risk. And nothing there should bring in politics, okay? Then there's people who are like, this seems interesting. If I don't eat lunch today, I can buy $20 worth of it. I think I'll buy a little bit of this thing over time because this one seems like a risk worth taking. And again, this goes into other things. I don't like to beat people up with just the Bitcoin thing and rubbing it in that you didn't listen and now you wish you did. I remember when I bought my first second house. And I remember I have a family member, and he was like, that seems kind of risky. And this dude had just bought an SUV that even back then was like a house payment. And I'm thinking, so I have a house payment on a house. It's a second house that I own. And I already have a tenant that makes my house payment for me. What I'm doing is, in his mind, risky. But it's okay that he's spending $680 a month on a car because we need a car. And since the kids play sports, we need an SUV. They had two SUVs. The other car they had was paid for was an SUV. I can't make this up, you know? And, you know, right now, his wife is driving a car on an 84-month loan like Humble Mechanic mentioned. And it's like a Ford Fusion or something, and it's like $600 a month. But I was the one that took the risk all those years ago in his mind. See, now, I never saw that as a risk. I saw it as a house. It's got real property. We ended up living there. That's the place we lived in, by the way. We rented it to my niece. They were living in Arkansas. And then we moved in, and then we sold it, and we made money on it. And we sold the house we were living in that we made money on, and we banked when we moved up there. And then we took some of the money we banked out of that, and we bought the house that we have now. I never saw any of that as risky. But I did see there was risk in it, but it was a conservative approach to balancing risk. And this is something we don't teach. By the way, shouldn't we be teaching everything I'm fucking telling you right now to kids by the time they're in high school? Don't you think if somebody would have talked to you like this when you were a 15-year-old kid in school, you would have been there like, oh, whatever, Mr. Bechtel's talking about factoring equations again. And you would have went, what? What? Say more of that shit. But no, we don't teach people this because people that are like this write their own rules and society can't have that shit. Fuck that, right? And then the last thing is saving. Everybody's investing. There's a place for good old-fashioned saving, and saving is a very simple thing. In fact, to invest, you must save. To invest, you must save, right? About the only exception to some degree is real estate. Real estate, the reason so many people become rich with real estate is you can use other people's money to invest. That's why. If otherwise, to truly invest is to take your money and put it into something that yields something back to you, right? So thou must have money before thou may invest money, right? So to have money, thou must save, and save is simple. There's an outgoing column in your life balance sheet, and there's an incoming. And if the outgoing is equal to or greater than the incoming, thou will not save and thou will not invest. So basic financial people that financially manage their life well tend to do well through change and adaptation. And the person who, don't tell me you went to Possible High School, bro. Tom somebody here. Do you know who I'm talking about? He was a good teacher. If you do, let me know. That would be cool as shit, right? But wow, that gave me a throwback. So people that save, invest well, take conservative risk balance, make sure they know how to feed themselves, and do all these things. They get through these time periods. So you need to model that behavior now because, trust me, it's only going to get worse. I think we are living through this wonderful fiction in our heads that, as bad as it is, it has to get better tomorrow. No, it doesn't, and it probably won't. If it does, I'll be happy to be wrong. This is a job, if you want to call it that, where, man, I don't ever like having to say I was wrong, but I like being wrong a lot of times, right? Damn it, Tom. I thought he said he's just messing around. I thought maybe we went back that far together. That would have been cool. Anyway, so what are the basics of lifestyle design then? How do we actually make all this work? Number one, we have to define our goals. What do you want? Most people don't know what the fuck they want. They have no idea what they want. They couldn't explain it to you if they tried. They couldn't explain it to you if explaining it clearly and articulately meant that just by explaining it, they would get it. Here's the scary part. If you get to the point where you can do that, you'll probably get what you want. Now, you have to have a modicum of common sense and reason and logic. and a reasonable timeline. I'm not saying if you're like, I want 6 Lamborghinis, I want 5 mansions, like you start naming shit like that. Like, you probably actually don't even want that. You just think you do because it's a status symbol, right? Like, you're going to get a lot of chicks or something if you have that or whatever. You must be happy because that's what everybody wants. But if you actually figure out what you want, now you have a destination. If you want to go somewhere, you have to know where you're going. So you have to sit down and define your goals of what you really want. And a lot of that is defining what you don't want. I want lots of money. Okay, so does everybody. Why? I don't want to worry about paying my bills anymore. Okay, so you don't want the stress of having to pay bills that you can't afford. That's what you want. Money is the mean by that. But now we know what you want, okay? Okay, how can you have that? First thing we'll do is look at all the bills and how many of them are really bills for things you need versus want, and how many of them are things you think you want you don't even really want. You start clarifying what you want, you might realize, I kind of do want this thingamabob over here, but I want this lifestyle more. So thingamabob goes away. Yeah. Just saying. You have to define the steps to get there honestly with yourself. So if you want to be a millionaire by the time you're 30 and you have 10 years to do it in, then you need to build value at an average rate of $100,000 a year. Now, you can start out lower in year one, but in the end, if you're not progressing toward that aggregate average, you're not going to make it. It doesn't necessarily have to be cash either. If it's a real estate investor, but the underlying equity in the property of $1 million, you're a millionaire. Underlying free liquidable equity in the property. In other words, I may not sell the property, but right now, if I sold everything in reasonable pricing, I could get it all sold and closed in 60 days, and I walk away with $1 million in cash after I pay taxes, you're a millionaire. But if you're not meeting that goal, then you're not going to hit that final goal. People like to throw round numbers. I want to be worth $10 million by the time I'm 50. They don't even know what it means. So you have to lay out the plan. What does it take to get me to where I want to be? If that is, I want my property paid for. There's a couple approaches at it, and they're like, you can double down on your mortgage payments, triple down, right? You can move, get a lower cost property. Really hard to do right now, but there are ways always to do it. You know, even people say, well, I want a big old place out in the country. Well, why? I don't like where I live. Let's list all the things. The best way to figure out what you want is to list all the things you don't want and figure out how to get rid of them. That leads you to what you want. Then you have to prioritize the steps. So many people start with like what should be the last step first because it's a fun one. What I always tell people, my wife just had a week to herself. She said, there's 5 things I want to get done. And one was, I want to clean out my office. She ended up not listening to me, and she ended up getting it done barely. But what I knew of all the things she wanted to do, cleaning up her office was the one she least wanted to do. What do you think I suggested? And I don't tell my wife shit. I'm smarter than that. But what do you think I suggested she do? Well, I suggested she clean the office first. And I bet you she would have had a couple days to sit around and look at her feet, you know, in the pool if she had done that first. Because there was a lot of effort in deferring that one we don't want to do. So usually when we prioritize everything we really don't want to do, move it to the front of the line. Everything we really wanted to do, move it to the back of the line. And then go in and logically, not emotionally, adjust from there. Because it might be the case, this thing I'm really not looking forward to really can't be done until next year. And you should be planning that long if you really want to design your life. You live a long time, you have to plan with a long time horizon. And then we have to start taking action. Do something. Do fucking something. Get it going. Make it happen. Like, do something today to move toward where you want to be. I don't know what it is. You know, one of the people I really love in kind of in my orbit and in this space is Nicole Sauce, expert council member, good friend. We go back, I guess, more than 10 years together now. She has her thing called My 3 Things. You give yourself 3 things that must be done every day. You put them down. And like, if you have to murder somebody to get your 3 things done, then those 3 things get done before everything else. And she has contingencies like, but what if it's really an easy day and I don't have anything I really need to do and I only have one thing? Well, then on that day, you have that one thing. Well, what if I have no thing? Come up with one thing. Do one thing every day. Take an action. Do something. See, people that take this approach to life win. You know, one of my favorite people and least favorite people, depending on what we're talking about, if we're talking about getting out of debt, he's my favorite person in the world. If we're talking about investing, he's my least favorite. And the only person I see as a person I despise more as an investment source of information is Jim Cramer. Because Jim Cramer will just make you lose money. The inverse Cramer affects real. In fact, Cramer's very valuable as an investment advisor. Just do the fucking opposite of what he said. You know, I think somebody made a mutual fund doing that or something. If not, they should. The inverse Cramer fund, right? They do the exact opposite. Especially if you just say, like, well, duh. Like, everybody knows that. You just take the well done. You take anything that's a legitimate call from Cramer and do the opposite, you'll be fine, right? So the person that I think his investment advice is crap, but his debt advice is great, is Dave Ramsey, right? Dave Ramsey has a great way to get out of debt. But one of the things Dave Ramsey says is people that win with money tend to win in life. Well, I'll tell you why. Because if you take Dave's approach to debt elimination, and even his investment advice isn't terrible. There's just better, okay? It's too conservative. It's just buy indexed mutual funds and don't worry about it. Like that's it. Put 10 to 15% of your income in that and don't worry about it. Yeah, you know, no. But it's a form of lifestyle design. You know, it's envelope system. You put everything. It's getting harder to even do, right? Like you can tell it was made by a boomer because it doesn't work in 2024 anymore. But you put all your money in cash. You pay all your bills, you buy all your groceries with cash so that you feel it. It's not just a number on a screen. And, you know, you plan out your budget and everything. Well, most of the things in our life have a cost. See, he's just tricking you. See, I'm honest. I'm telling you to design your life. He's tricking you into designing your life, right? He's using catchphrases to get you to design your life. What in your life doesn't cost money? The sunrise. Okay, and how do you view the sunrise? Well, I go look at it. Okay, where do you view it from? My backyard. Well, how much does your house cost? What do you value your time at? Right, everything is transactional in one way or another. So, and if you just want more time to stare at the sunrise, then you need more free time. Well, how does that come about? Everything will come back in your world today because the way the world is designed will come back to money. So if you take control of your money, you will take control of your life. That's the secret. That's why the man is successful after years of saying the same shit. Like, I can literally host a show tomorrow and not the Jack Spirko version. Like, if I had a synthesizer that made me sound like old Boomer Ramsey, no one would know he's not there. It's that predictable. He's going to say there's like 10 pieces of advice formulated 5 different ways each. And with my memory and my ability to go without a script, I could sit there and do that, and yet he's a phenomenal success. Why? Good marketing, good management, good operations, but what he's teaching works. Even if it's not optimum, it's good enough that it works. And when people follow your advice and it makes their life better, you develop loyalty from them. That's what's going on there. So lifestyle design works, even when it's not perfect. And then you have to ask yourself, well, Jack, if it's that simple, why is it so uncommon? Why are most people carried along like leaves that blow out of the tree in autumn, land in a creek and end up who knows where and rot? And two leaves, you know, you make a big deal out of where people are born, what family they come into, what school they went to. Think of it like trees, leaves, two leaves on the same branch, as close to each other as can be, same parent, wind blows, one catches a little sideways, one catches a little differently. They fall. One catches the wind current, one lands right at the base of the tree. Deer comes along, eats one, shits it out in the forest. The other one lands in a creek, goes down the creek, out to the lake, because this creek is dammed, and it ends up in a lake, and it ends up as muck on the side of the lake, and it rots in and helps grow a new tree, right? Both of them actually help grow new trees. Their paths are completely divergent. They have the same point of origin, the same opportunity, but unlike a human, neither one of them could think. if it's as simple as I say it is, why don't most people do it? And before I explain that, how about what the alternative is if you don't do it? Somebody did it for you. The way we know this is so effective is insurance companies almost never go bankrupt. They gamble professionally for a living, and they almost always make billions of dollars in profit. You ever wonder how they do it? By the time you're 20, 25 years old, we know if you're a smoker or not. We know if you have high blood pressure or not. We know just a few statistics about you that a trained insurance agent can gather from you on a single simple form in about 5 minutes' time. We can, with a great deal of certainty, say you'll probably live to be X. But if we go deeper with demographers, you'll probably have a maximum salary in your life of Y. You'll reach that at this age. This is when you'll begin a decline in your earnings. This is what your retirement will look like. Insurance companies can tell you all these things. Now, on any one person, they can be drastically wrong. But on the aggregate average, they're going to be exceedingly right, like in the neighborhood of 75 to 85% of the time, right? So they can write an insurance policy on your life that you pay into, and whenever they do pay it out, they made a profit. Because it's that predictable. Because central planners have already planned your life. They planned your life. If you're white collar, blue collar, live in Philadelphia, live in Florida, the people that build prisons literally look at the output of the public education system in the area they're going to build prisons to know how many prisons to build and how big to make them. I'm not making that shit up. So now you really should say, why don't more people do it? Like, if the alternative is somebody else decided when I'm going to take vacation, if I'm going to take vacation, how old I'm going to be, what kind of diseases I'm likely to get, how fat I'm going to be, how miserable or happy I'm going to be. If it's already put in place that those things are preordained, if I don't take action and nothing prevents me from taking action, why don't people do it? Well, number one, it requires something that we have been convinced we shouldn't have to make: sacrifice. Now, you'll notice the state always wants you to sacrifice things to benefit them, right? To benefit their goals and their agenda, which will someday maybe benefit you. But when it comes down to really making sacrifice, even the politicians don't tell you you need to sacrifice. They tell you the other people are responsible for your sacrifice. And isn't it funny, whether you believe in the D's or the R's or the big L's or anything, it's always the other person's fault. Even when everybody has the same common complaint. It's funny, isn't it? It requires sacrifice. And people just generally don't like to sacrifice. I had conversations with my daughter-in-law about having a budget. She says, you don't want me to spend money. I said, you're a grown-ass adult. You spend all the money you want. I just want you to know how much. I want you to set your own boundary. She's a spender. You know? So as my son's crossed a bear, not mine, you know? There's so many people like that, though. I'm not picking on her. She's a wonderful person. But people don't even want, like, most people don't even have a budget. And you'll listen to somebody like expert council member John Pugliano. He's like, I don't have a budget. Yeah, he's not so wealthy. And he does have a budget. He has a conservative mindset toward his spending. He buys quality things for the long term because of where he is now in his life. He doesn't have a budget anymore. He doesn't worry if he's, you know, when he goes to the grocery store and last week it was $220 and this week it's $250, he doesn't care. You get there eventually. I guarantee you, young John Pugliano that was an officer in the United States Army, had a budget. Or he wouldn't have gotten to where he was, right? So that's a sacrifice. Everything we're talking about is a sacrifice. Spending time learning a skill instead of going out with your buddies and drinking beer and fishing is a sacrifice. Going fishing for food in a way that is productive and profitable versus going out with a guy and drinking a bunch of beer while he does all the work is a sacrifice. Everything that actually makes things better in your life has some degree of sacrifice. Even if you enjoy it, there's something you probably could enjoy more than doing it right when you're doing it. So when it comes to, like, I'm going to drive a used vehicle, it's a sacrifice. When it comes to, I'm going to skip buying, you know, a complete new ensemble of clothing this year because the clothes I have are fine. You know, buy one or two things because these things are wearing out, right? That's a sacrifice. And the problem is that many people, even when they sacrifice the wrong shit. Or they don't sacrifice broadly enough. And they also don't know where they're going. So the fact that it requires anything of you before it gives back to you is going to knock 50% of the people out before we can get started. And that is the number one thing that knocks people out. Requires something else, though. This is going to, now you're down to 50%. Now we're going to knock it down to 25% of people in society who will do it. We're going to knock another 50% of the remainder out. It requires being honest with yourself. You just took us from 100% of people that could do something to 25 with those two requirements. People do not like to be honest with themselves. The most effective therapists are very empathic people with the strong bullshit detector. It's not that they tell people what to do. It's they know when the person is not being honest, and they probe and they push and they force that person into an honest discussion, and that therapist isn't really the person they're having a discussion with. This is a trick therapists use, and it's a benevolent trick. You're actually having, when you have a good therapist, you're having a conversation with yourself. They're just, you're playing with a ball, and they're the wall. There's really nobody else there. If you take the wall away, though, and you throw the ball, it's not a very fun game anymore, is it, right? And you definitely can't get into a rhythm. It's like fetch without a dog. Huh, I guess I'll go get it, and then you go, and throw it back. It's pretty pointless. But you put that ball there, that wall there, and you can play. Or you take a ping pong table, turn one side up, and play against yourself, right? That's what that therapist is. But they're forcing you to have an honest discussion with yourself, which means people don't want to do it. So you have to be honest about, well, can I really do this? And sometimes you would think that the problem is that people say they can do something they can't do. Actually, the problem is often that people say they can't do something that they could do. There's no way I could ever XYZ, right? Now, sometimes it's because they don't really want to take that path. And you'd think that's pretty benevolent then, right? Like, I could never be an engineer. They really could. They have the aptitude, the intelligence, the mathematical understanding. They have it. It's there. They could become an engineer. They don't really want to become an engineer. Yeah? And so by saying that, you would think that would do no harm. But it does. It sets a pattern. It sets a pattern of ruling out things that you don't want by saying you're not capable rather than you don't want. Okay, cognitive dissonance just became your best friend. It will be there your entire life. You will never have an honest conversation with yourself ever. If you don't want to do something, don't say you can't. Don't say you're unable. Here's one, because I've stopped answering these fucking questions. Jack, I've got this old 30-06, and I hunted with it most of my life using iron sights, and my old eyes just don't see the way they used to anymore. I need to be able to take shots out to about 50 to 100 yards. Okay, stop. Unless you're fucking blind, you can hit a fucking deer at 100 yards with a 30-06. If you ever could, you might need new glasses. But you still could. Just say, I want a fucking scope. Right? Don't make an excuse for a viable product that will make you a better shot and improve your life. There's nothing wrong with wanting a scope. You don't need an excuse for it. Now, take that analogy into all these different things. You don't need a reason to not want something, and you don't need a reason to want it. Now, reasons are important when you're making decisions about actually executing. But just in determining where you want to go, so you have to be honest with yourself and sacrifice. Now we're down to 25% of the people. Here's why that's a good thing. Because the 75% that won't do it are not going to compete with you. You understand that? They're not going to compete with you. And there's even a lot of people that will do it, but they feel that once I've done a certain point, I don't have to anymore. These are people that graduate college with degrees, sometimes fancy one, MBAs and shit. And at that point, they want a good job and fuck it. They're not going to compete with you either. They will sacrifice, but their sacrifice is short timeline focused. They have a very short time preference. They think life's like television. Once I get the degree, I'll hang out with my friends at the coffee shop and work a few hours a day. Not the way it works. So they'll get a dose of reality, but then they feel kind of resentful. I made all the sacrifices. I did all the work. I stayed up late and studied. I got the A's. I did all the stuff. My life's not great. Fuck it. I'll just do what I have to get by. I'll quietly quit. How much of that's going on? People, you're familiar with the term quietly quitting? Google it if you're not. Probably half the people in America are quietly quitting right now. It means doing just enough to not get fired. So that's good. That it requires sacrifice and honesty because you just wiped out 75% of your potential competitors and whatever you're trying to. It requires taking responsibility for where you are. For where you are. Not where you're going, that too, but primarily where you are. In fact, one of the first things you have to do to fix your fucking life and make it go in the direction you want it to is determine where you are and how you got there. That requires honesty with yourself about all the shit you made mistakes along the way doing. I think sometimes when I talk about my past and all the shit that I went through and all of the wins I had, people think like, Jack, he's like a magic touch. I'm not fucked up shit left and right. I was willing to take the risk, fuck the shit up, own the fucked up shit, and move on. And I sit sometimes now and I go, how the fuck did you get here? Sometimes I'm afraid I'm going to wake up and it was all one big, like, 16-year hallucination of doing this podcast. Like, how did I possibly win this big with all these mistakes? Then I remember the words of Michael Jordan, you miss every shot you don't take. You miss every shot you don't take. I made the most shots because I took the most shots, right? And you don't have to win in this game. You don't have to, like, make the most shots. You just have to make a lot of them. You have to make the clutch ones, the right ones. So to do that, you're going to have to honestly live up to how you got where you are. If you explain to me that the reason you're in the spot you're in life that's not great, and it involves two or three times of talking about what somebody else did, you're not ready yet. I don't mentor people really, but if I did, I wouldn't take you. You're not ready. Your cup is too full, right? As the old Chinaman would say, your cup is too full. Like, I want to hear the person say, well, I made this mistake. And if that means somebody misled you, you trusted them. That's on you, right? There's probably several things along the way that you can say, that was a sign that I shouldn't have and I did anyway. Now we're starting to have an honest conversation with ourselves. Now we can start to locate ourselves. Now, those things of sacrifice, honesty, and responsibility for where you are equal your current position. Earlier we talked about setting a destination. I tell you to go to Philadelphia. What's the first thing you need to know? Where Philadelphia is? No. Where you are. Well, you know where you are. Not necessarily. What if I blindfolded you and put you in a helicopter, and the helicopter flew in circles, a bunch of wider and wider circles, and it finally went out, so you have no sense of direction. You're sitting in some small town somewhere. There's no signs. I give you keys and a car. And if I say, if you can get to Philadelphia before the end of the week, there's a suitcase waiting at this address with $1 million in it, you get $1 million. What is the first thing you need to know? Where you are. You know how you got there, but you don't know where you are. But if you could map the helicopter's destination, which is yours, so you could figure out where you are. Getting to where you want to go is easy now, isn't it? How easy is it to get to Philadelphia? I can pretty much give you directions from my house to Philadelphia without looking at a map. Why? I've driven not to Philly from here before, but that way, and I know where I am. Tell me I'm in South Dakota, pretty big state, and not where. I can kind of say, you know, you need to get, you know, but I really would have to, like, know where is this place. Now say, tell me how to get to Philadelphia, but I won't tell you where I am. I have no fucking idea. So figuring out where you are, how you got there, and having an honest conversation with yourself that puts the majority, if not 100% of the responsibility on yourself for being there is necessary for you to figure out how to get where you want to be. Okay, so now we locked another half of what. Now we're down to 12.5% of people. Now we're down to 12.5% of people. Last one, it requires the courage to do what most won't. It requires the willingness to take that risk. It requires the willingness that when everybody's saying, hey, just come out with us, and you say, look, I'm trying to save money right now. And your buddy goes, yeah, man, there's going to be hot chicks there. I'm talking about when you're younger now, right? There's going to be hot chicks out. It's Friday night, man, Friday night. I'll pick up two drinks for you so at least you can drink. Cover charge is only $5, man. Come on out with us. Like, you don't think that takes courage? Stepping out of the pack. Look, man, have a good time. No, man, you're my wingman. You'll find another wingman. What are you going to do tonight, man? I'm going to go down the park and go fishing. And it's going to cost me no money. Then when I go home, I'm going to cook the fish I catch, and dinner's going to be free. I'm going to go out one night a week, Saturday night. It's going to be my night to go out. Or whatever it is. That actually takes courage. It's not just buying the second house and leasing it to somebody that takes courage. It takes courage to change who you are into what you say you want to be. That takes courage. So now we've taken our 12.5%, right? And we've cut it down to what, 6.25? It's about 6%, 5 to 6% of the population. 5 to 6% of the population holds 85 to 90% of the wealth outside of the elite. Funny. Funny how that fucking works, isn't it? That if you just look at the four things really required to design and direct your own life, and you knock in half the total population each time, you get right to the number that is the vast majority of people that control the most amount of wealth. And when I say wealth, I'm not only measuring in dollars. I'm talking about people that really have lives that they love. Live where they want to live. Have people in it that they want in it. Never worry about paying their bills. You know what I worry about? My grandson's future. I worry about my grandson's future. I don't even think about it's the first of the month we have to pay the mortgage. I don't give a fuck. I don't care. Money's there. I can do nothing for the next 5 years. That's going to be covered. I might not like the way it looks while it's happening, but I'm not worried about it. It's because of a willingness to sacrifice, be honest, take responsibility for where you are, and have the courage to act, where most people won't. And there will come a point where the amount of sacrifice goes down. But think about what I just said. I could write it out for the next 5 years. Who knows what I could figure out to do with those 5 years? But every morning I get up and come produce the show because it's what I really want. But how much courage does it take to turn to your partners and go, I'm going to sell off my ownership of the business to you guys for almost nothing because I've been doing this other thing and I want to go be a podcaster for the rest of my life. You think that's without risk? If you think that's without risk, you don't understand the position that I was in, the favorable position that I was in, the income that I had, the ownership stake that I had, the connections that I had there. Everything that went away when I pulled the plug on that and walked away from it, that took courage. I'm not building myself up with that or trying to say, look how great I am. I'm just saying it takes guts to do things like that. And if you want to have what you want to have, then you're going to have to take those four big steps. Again, they're real simple. Sacrifice that most people won't make. Honesty with yourself about yourself, right? Taking responsibility for where you currently are, the good and the bad, without blaming others, even when others did have an impact on you, even when somebody did do you wrong, you still have to take responsibility. Not everything's your fault, but everything's your responsibility. You're not a victim in life. You're a victim in circumstance or consequence. If somebody steals from you, they took that thing from you, and if you never recover it, you're a victim of that. But what you do with the rest of the life that you have, you're only their victim if you choose to be in that situation. Okay? My final thoughts on this are, there's nothing I've told you today that you can't do. There's nothing I've given anybody today that you can't do. If you have a pulse, you can fog a mirror. Okay? And you have an IQ that makes you functional. If you have a high enough IQ to stand trial, then you can do all these things. Various different levels of success, and a million. In fact, as many people as there are is how many paths there are. Even someone that takes a path that looks very similar to yours will have major divergences from it, which is the point. In the world, the words of Richard Bach, whatever the population is at any given time on Earth, that's how many worlds there are. Each one of us creates our own world in our own mind from our own perception, our own fears, our own courages, our own bias. We all do this for ourselves. And the beauty of it is that that means we can paint any victory we choose. The scary part is most will choose to paint failure in their own life and then live to regret it and then look back and wish it could have been different. The thing is, it could have been different. And there'll be a point where you have this reckoning. And if you didn't do this now, there'll be the point where you say you wish it could have been different, and it'll hurt. But then there'll be the point soon after that you'll say, it could have, not I wish it could have. It could have been different, and I didn't choose for it to be. And that will crush your soul at a time when your soul should be preparing to transition into whatever's next. It is that deep. It is that important. And there's probably not ever been a time in history where it's more true than at the edge of a transition, which is where we are right now. With that, let's go ahead. I got a couple questions, and then we'll wrap up. The new old man says, how can we capitalize on dollar's downfall? What does that look like, shorting the currency, taking out loans for buildings, equipment, and livestock? You know, a lot of people think that and they get wiped out. Any debt you take on, you better be able to service, even if everything goes left, right, sideways, up, or down. The whole show basically answered that question. You design your life in a resilient way, because if you do that, it doesn't matter if the dollar's value goes down. In fact, if you have lots of money and the dollar's value goes down, you're better off than not having lots of money and the dollar's value. And that might hurt more intellectually, but you're still better off than the person that's penniless. But keeping your debt low is huge. Now, I have a mortgage, I mentioned it, but you know what I owe? I owe like $140,000 on a house that's worth $500,000. You know, and it didn't happen overnight. We bought smart. We made revisions. We let markets do what markets do across time. We bought at the right time. Refinanced into even better terms. Paid a little extra here and there. I ain't paying no extra now. Like, so a mortgage can be a way to gain when the dollar's value goes down, so property prices go up. But to realize the gain, there's only two ways to do it. One, your income goes up along with the decline of the value, right? So you're still making the same money adjusted, and your house payment's cheap, and everybody around you has an expensive house payment. That's a microcosm. That's what we've managed to pull off here. But you know what I'm going to say? The place you should be investing right now with surplus capital is Bitcoin. And if you don't want that answer, I'm sorry. It's not going to change just because people don't want it. David Price says, just drove past Possible, Pennsylvania and thought of you. Love you for all you do. Thanks, David. I wonder if you just, when you say drove past, not through, I wonder if you like hooked ass down 81 or something like that and saw the exit for it. But there's a part of me that really wants to go back up there and see the place. And there's also a part of me that knows when I talk about places in America that weren't always great, but they were good. And they've been crushed and destroyed by drugs in this economy, that my hometown is at the top of the list for shit like that. I've been told you can't walk down Main Street in Pottsville now without walking by two or three people dealing heroin. And that is obscene to me. I mean, I grew, you know, in the 80s, everybody smoked pot or knew somebody that smoked pot. And everybody that knew somebody that smoked pot knew somebody you could get pot from, or knew somebody that knew somebody you could get pot from. Right. It wasn't a big deal. Like, there was a lot of, you know, drug use. But heroin, no one ever even, like, if you would have said, hey, man, let's go score some heroin, man. People would have been like, get this fucker away from me. 5 years after I left, my best friend's girlfriend died of a heroin overdose. That's what's happening in our country right now. And now it's fentanyl and all this other shit. We need, like you said, we need to be designing our lives, because what's been designed for us isn't good. what they're doing, if you want a term for it, they're Mexicanizing the country, right? If you look at Mexico, it's just fraught with regulations. You think it's freer, and in some ways it is, but in many ways it's not. And the elite in Mexico live lives that are elite envy, and everybody else is a peon. If you look at what's being done to this country, that's what they're doing to it. So you have to play outside the lines. Justin says, manufacturing used to be a major value add to society because of the first mover advantage. Where is the real value being added at the most basic level in 2025? That's a great question. I don't have an immediate answer for that. But what he's saying is, like, we were manufacturers in the 50s and 60s and 70s because we were innovators. We were designing the product and then making it. And then we went from designing it and making it to designing it and letting somebody else make it. And eventually, when you do that long enough, the people you're having make it for you figure out how to design it, and that starts to migrate. And then you say, well, you know, it's okay if the Chinese and Japanese design some of this stuff. We still have the best people right here. But, you know, if we had a research team that cost half as much as it does right now, so then we start outsourcing, like, the lower-level positions to New Delhi and shit like that, and all of a sudden we have nothing. I never said it was bad when we used to actually have manufacturing jobs in America. I just said that the jobs weren't as good from a day-to-day standpoint, right, of a quality of life for the worker as we have. Like, nostalgia is a very fickle mistress, man. Nostalgia can just trick you so much. How many people have you heard say this? The boomers took everything. Back when the boomers were our age, a man could work and he could pay all the bills. They're talking about fucking GIs, man. They're talking about your great-grandfather or your grandfather. They're talking about the 50s. Fucking boomers were barely being born and shitting their pants in the 50s. The boomers came up in the 1970s. Interest rates on houses were like 12 to 18 fucking percent. They went as high as 22% in the early Reagan days before that whole thing corrected. What crack are you smoking? The boomers raised Gen X. Gen X was the latchkey kids. If we had mom at home and dad working and dad could go work at the steel mill or the freaking lamp factory or the car factory or whatever and make enough money to pay for the whole household, if that was true, then why were we latchkey kids? Because it's not true. It's all bullshit. It's all a lie. Okay? It's all a lie. But nostalgia is easy to believe in. And most of us Gen Xers, unfortunately, we live for the nostalgia of the 50s. We believe that was all great. And so you start looking at it and go, oh, there's some really good shit in American High, but there was also some pretty bad shit too. And I don't think I really want to live the way they did back then with the limitations that they had on them that we don't have on us anymore. Every generation blames the one before. Okay? There's a reason it's in a song, because it's universal and it's true. So we have to be really careful that we don't look back with too much false nostalgia for a time we didn't know. And you'll notice something about people that think about the good old days. The good old days are inevitably just before what they actually can remember. Like, I really miss some things about the 80s. But I can also tell you there was a lot of fucked up shit in the 80s because I was actually there and lived for it. But if you talk about the 50s and 60s to me, I start to fall to the trap, right? Why? Because I didn't experience it. I listened to my grandparents and great uncles and shit talk about that time the way that I talked to my grandson about my time as a youth. And you tend to tell the kids the things that were good, and you leave a lot of the bad out because we protect kids. So that nostalgia is a sultry mistress that lies, right? She lies, and she's got a great lawyer when you get a divorce. So be careful with that shit. With that, before we wrap up, let's go ahead and remind you guys one of the ways you can help support us in the work that we do. And one of those ways is to do your online shopping at tspaz.com. T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is from Vivor. It is the galvanized raised garden beds. I have had some quality issues with Lavore, but I've probably sold more of these than anything else, and I haven't heard any complaints about them other than the film you have to take off them, and they take a long time to put together because there's a ton of screws. That's not a quality problem. Being able to put some panels together, throw it on the ground, fill it up with dirt, and have a garden bed, quickest, easiest, and most economical way that I know to do that. The 4x8x2-foot deep beds right now are on sale for like $96. You can't build them out of 2x lumber from Lowe's, pressure-treated lumber at Lowe's for that price. It'll cost you more, and it won't last as long. I've done the math. They also have the 1-foot deep ones, which most of you will be fine with, right? They're on sale for like $60 today. The reason I decided to bring these around today is not just because they're on sale, but it's, you know, it's well past mid-August. We're only, what is it, 4 days from the end of the month? We're going to September. Dove season starts, right? Like, it's fall. I know it didn't feel like fall, but it's fixing to be fall. If you want a fall garden, now or never, baby. Like, if you got to know where you are and where you're going, you're gardenless. You want a fall garden into, like, early winter garden this year, you need to do it now. And this is the easy button to get it done with. If you want to get ready to have a bigger season next year, this is a good time to do it. Next thing you're going to be hunting season. It's going to be cold out. You ain't going to be outside. Next thing you know, it's spring and you need to, you see what I'm saying? Like, it's time to act. And while they're on sale at this price, they're great deals, so check them out. Remember, you can find everything that I've ever reviewed and recommend at tspaz.com. And if I wouldn't spend my money on it, I wouldn't recommend it to you. With that, let's go ahead and Dally says, I think he's maybe a little bit behind us, but he says, they're bitching about the silent generation. They are. The Silent, yeah. Yeah, the Silent are even before the GIs, right? Some of the Silent went to the war, usually is a bit older, like my grandfather did. But the Silent, you know, lived through the Depression and all as adults. Yeah, they're that's who they're mainly talking about, the Silent. They had it so easy. All they had to do was live through the Great Fucking Depression, take jobs working for the Civilian Conservation Corps, one of the other alphabets that FDR created, and just, you know, live on almost nothing and, you know, be happy to have a plate to put their dirt on or something. And they had it great. Like, yeah, that false nostalgia will get you. The beauty is the past is what it is. You can lie about it, and plenty of people do. Most of the history you were taught is true. And has lies built into it at the same time. I don't think George Washington chopped down the fucking cherry tree, okay? I never can tell a lie. I think that's some bullshit. I think there's a book called Founding Myths. It's really, really interesting. But whatever the past is, it is. And all we can do is glean from it patterns that will tell us what the future will probably look like. But tomorrow isn't written. Tomorrow is under your control. You control everything in your life from this second forward. That's it. And once that second passes, it's gone. And 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 you only get a say from that point forward, which means you have a dramatic ability to influence what will be in a year, 2, 3, 5, 10, 20, until you dirt nap. You have a say in this second right now and everything in your future until the end. Some say in it. Even in the worst of circumstances, you have some say in it. Okay? But you have no say about yesterday. So you know what to do. Define your goals, define the steps to get there, prioritize the steps, begin taking action. To get that done, there's four other things you got to do. Make sacrifice, be honest with yourself, take responsibility for where you are, and have the courage to do what most want. Do that, and I can't promise you success, but I promise you more success than you'd have had if you didn't do it. I'll catch you tomorrow. We'll be talking about freedom technology with Moritz Kaminsky.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have. Let me show you a better way.